Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of the multifaceted writer Rachel Pollack. She was the author of 41 books, including two award-winning novels, Unquenchable Fire, winner of the Arthur C. Clarke Award, and Godmother Night, winner of the World Fantasy Award. Her comics work includes Doom Patrol, The New Gods, Tomahawk, The Geek, and Timebreakers. She also wrote a series of books about tarot cards that have sold all over the world and is the creator of The Shining Tribe Tarot, which she designed and drew herself. As a trans woman, Pollack advocated tirelessly for transgender rights and wrote transgender characters into her stories. For this episode, we are joined by Joe Corallo, comic book writer and graphic novelist, Neil Gaiman, best-selling and multi-award-winning author of various genres, and Mary Kay Greer, renowned tarot scholar and writer. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Joe, Neil, and Mary are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place May 31st, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Mary, Joe, and Neil, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. Looking forward to talking about Rachel Pollack with you and learning more about her impact and on you personally, and also culturally. But before we get into that, I'd like for each of you to tell us a little bit about yourselves. Joe, would you like to get us started?
Sure. I'm Joe Corallo, and I'm a writer and editor, mostly of comics. And I had the privilege of getting to know Rachel and collaborating with her on multiple comics.
Great. Thank you. And Mary, how about yourself?
So I'm Mary Greer. I've been doing tarot for 56 years and met Rachel 38 years ago in Amsterdam when I was there teaching a class on tarot. And she was also living there and teaching. So we've worked together for over 36 years.
Wow, that's great. What a long time friend and collaboration to have. And Neil, how about yourself?
Neil Gaiman. I've written all sorts of things, books and comics and television and songs and so forth. And I've known you, Rachel, for 39 years. I knew her. We met in 1985 when I was a young journalist and I was interviewing her about Salvador Dali's tarot. And we sort of hit it off during the interview, and then 3 days later, 2 days later, we both found ourselves at the Milford Science Fiction Writers Workshop, a week-long workshop where there were about 15 of us cast away in a tiny seaside hotel in the off-season. And Rachel and I would talk all through that. So later, our careers intertwined. I got her to do the Vertigo Tarot, for example, for DC Comics, and we were friends till the end.
Yeah, that's great. Lovely. That's one thing I've loved in reading about Rachel and hearing other writers and contemporaries share their thoughts, especially upon her passing, was the friend that she was. As an outsider myself, of course there's the literary aspects and that is incredible, but the friendships that she had and like long time friendships as well. So I'd love to hear more about who she was, just on a day-to-day basis. Nielsen, you knew her a while, perhaps you could share some insights into that.
She was incredibly funny.
Yes.
And I think that's the first thing that you need to know about Rachel. And the second thing you have to know about Rachel is that her sense of humor was uniquely her own. So every now and then she would crack herself up at a joke that only she saw or a joke that was so old. And she loved ancient Jewish jokes, but she also saw the world in her own unique way and occasionally would find incredible humor in things that would also be terrifying or weird. Her work, I love that her work on Doom Patrol is being rediscovered now, 30 years after she did it, and people are looking at it and they're going, hang on, this stuff's really funny. And it is, but it was as if at the time nobody knew what to make of it. And now we have enough perspective. So she was funny. She told stories and existed in stories and had a story for everything and loved questions. She was practically, for want of a better word, rabbinical in that sense, in that you couldn't ask Rachel the wrong question. If you were curious about something and she knew something about it and you didn't, she would tell you things. And sometimes if you knew something about something, she could add a missing part to it. I remember once talking to her. She was the only other human being I'd ever run into. We were talking strange sort of bits of the Midrash and the idea that after the Messiah comes back, in some branches of Jewish thinking, all of the men are out front in an enormous tent made out of the skin of the behemoth, eating dishes cooked from behemoth and leviathan, and the women are in the back cooking. And I commented that I thought that this was rather problematic, even by 1985 standards. And I just remember her filling me in on the bits that I didn't know, which were that the women would also be having babies continually, and after each baby was born, their virginity would be magically restored to them. You know, it's sort of, she was filled with this stuff. It was, she knew so much, and it shows up in her fiction, it shows up in her tarot work, it showed up in her conversation, and it showed up in her life.
Yeah, well said. And such a vast knowledge of those myths and stories is from also what I've been reading, a little bit of the interest that she had in tarot, right Mary, every civilization really has had the seers, right, the prophets, the
exactly.
So Mary, maybe you could speak a little bit about that and the her interest in the tarot community and those ancient stories.
Well, definitely myth infused everything that she did with tarot. So someone would come in with a question with a very mundane, when is he coming back? What's going on with, will I get this job? And we had different perspectives in that I felt free to change somebody's question if I felt that they were kind of stuck. And she said, no, honor the question. They came, they have a specific question. The first thing we have to do is honor that. And then she would ask them, she'd write it down and ask them to talk more about that question, their issue, what was going on. And she'd write down what they would say about it, the kind of the backstory and their concerns. And she would turn that into a spread. Most tarot readers have fixed spreads that they use. And, they're used to that kind of layout. And then, so it became the whole story around it, even though she really acknowledged and honored that first question. And out of that came this whole mythic dimension to what their issue was. It was no longer kind of the little story of, where did we fuck up or, anything like that. It was a journey. She would tie it, depending on the cards, back into myths that they related to. So people started seeing themselves as being on one of these, great archetypal journeys in life. So that, talking to other people as well as, some readings we exchanged. And of course, over the years, co-teaching for 36 years, I've seen her do this with so many people. It's just amazing. So one of the things I loved was taking walks with her because she would always see these amazing connections, two trees intertwined around each other, something in an animal that would cross our paths. And that would become its own story, its own myth. So it was like an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I always delighted in having those opportunities to walk and see things through her eyes, and sharing that. So I don't know, there's so many stories. I was thinking back to the beginning. Before I actually met her, we both lived in London at the same time. And I was involved with the first Women's March in London at the same time she was writing the first transsexual manifesto and working on that. We didn't know each other until a few years later than that, actually. Let me see, from 71 to about 85, 86, so however many years that is, before we actually met. But I feel sort of like we were supposed to meet. We met at De Cosmos in Amsterdam, you know, the great cosmos. Everything seemed to be part of this amazing story of connection. And she came to visit when I was teaching at the Omega Institute in upstate New York. She had, was just moving back to Rhinebeck and asked them if they could teach, if she could teach at the Omega Institute, because she was going to be living in the same town. And they said, well, teaching tarot, we already have a tarot teacher. And the minute I heard that, I called them up and said, what? You're Rachel wants to teach here? Yes, we've got to do it together. And they said, you know, you'll be splitting your class and the payment and everything. I go, whatever, whatever. You know, right away, I realized that this was not an opportunity to miss. And that was, it grew through the years because we ended up teaching so many different places together and would argue for our students so that they could see that there were different perspectives. Most of the time we kind of made up the arguments, but occasionally it was a real argument that we would continue over the next meal. But that never interfered with, you know, the relationship. We were able to do that, to have different perspectives, to really learn from each other. And that was the other thing about her. She learned from everyone that she encountered, which I think was one reason why she valued friendship so much. She could see in everyone that she interacted with something of value that they were bringing to the situation.
Yeah.
So I could go on, but yeah, let's pause on mine for a minute.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mary. That was great. Joe, how about you? Any you know, because you also a friend and also working collaborator as well, right?
Yeah. One thing about Rachel, again, incredibly funny and just one of the most unique people probably to ever live. The first time I went to visit her in Rhinebeck about 7-8 years ago or so, it was imperative to her that she take me to the post office there, because the Rhinebeck post office is just so beautiful, and the molding and the ceiling and all that. And I don't think I will ever in my life meet another person who is that excited to take me to their local post office. just the pure joy she had about everything. I mean, to the humor, there was one time I remember we were in the car and something came up relating to, you know, queer rights and all that. And she just goes, I forget. Do we like Dan Savage right now, or we don't like Dan Savage? I forget where we are on that right now, as those opinions wax and wane over time. But I think one of the other incredibly unique things about her is her, it's her innocence. It's like, I don't want to say, you know, naive, because not that she's naive, but just the way she would talk about things and people. And we would have these really earnest conversations, you know, in between talking about how much we love Little Lulu and, you know, Carl Barks is the good duck artist, for those who are familiar with Uncle Scrooge, and you know, her love of, you know, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, Gene Colan, and things like that. You know, she would ask me very, like, genuinely, like, how is it that there are, you know, other trans and queer people out there who don't want to, like, just be out and express themselves and don't want to be part of this amazing, like, community and things like that, and asking in a very, you know, sort of genuine and sincere way, She had this way about her where she would ask questions like that a lot, like to Mary's point before about how inquisitive she was. But most people would ask those questions in a way that, you know, you're not supposed to ask them. They're a rhetorical question, but she didn't seem to ask rhetorical questions, but they would sound rhetorical, and she was wanting a conversation, wanting an answer of some kind. And I think that always made her incredibly unique in that fashion. And one of the things about her, it's so tragic that she's gone, but I'll also say she was never going to stop creating new ideas. If she lived to be 200, she would still be scribbling down ideas and talking about, you know, the next three or four books, you know, she wanted to write. So there was never going to be a time where her leaving us wasn't going to be tragic.
Mm. Well put. And it also makes me think, Joe shared the story you wrote for the forthcoming DC collection of Rachel's work, and I just reread it again this morning in preparation for that. Okay. I love what you were just saying made me think of like the I don't want to give too much away, but like just that story is like, they're, you know, people like Rachel Pollack are never really gone, you know. Yeah. Like there's that never the end for someone who has had such a importance and influence in multiple communities, like tarot, comics, science fiction, fantasy, you know, the transgender rights. It's just a very singular person indeed.
Yeah, it's also interesting that like some of her creations, like Codpiece in Doom Patrol, were adapted in both animation and live action in pretty rapid succession, you know, in the last like year and a half. And it's so interesting to me. And on top of that, exactly to your point, I think someone could make, you know, a movie or a series or something out of Unquenchable Fire or Godmother Night 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and people would talk about like, wow, this is what a breath of fresh air, what a new and innovative way to, you know, look at the world and examine these sort of topics from these books that came out, you know, at that point, you know, several decades ago, you know, if they were to adapt them, you know, 15 years or so from now. So,
yeah, that does lead me to, you know, one of my questions is, you have kind of spoken to it already, but the, you know, what about her writing makes it so endearing?
Well, one of the things that you'd asked is if we could actually read a little bit.
I would love that. Yeah.
And I thought if you let me, I would read a little bit of Unquenchable Fire, just from the first chapter. Unquenchable Fire won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in about 1989. And I just remember being so proud of Rachel for winning this. It was a big literary award, it still is, but up until that point, the Arthur C. Clarke Award had really tended to go to major literary figures who'd somehow dabbled in something science fictional. And here was Rachel writing this sui generis book, unlike anything else, set in that most romantic of places, Poughkeepsie, but set in a future in which the world had become mystic, essentially. Mm. Magic is now part of the conversation. And I thought I'd just read a little. Once Bob Gobie, fresh from his victory as the first non-revolutionary Republic city manager in 30 years, asked the current public secretary, "And when's the last time any tellers did all those things?" adding, "The real tellers died off years ago, and you know it as well as I do." The secretary stood up from his desk. "If we refrain from exposing the spirit in its raw state," he told City Manager Gobie, "we do so for our listeners' well-being in respect of their weaknesses and fears." "Sure," Gobie said, angry beyond all sense. "Don't give me that shit. everyone knows you refrain because you can't. You don't know how anymore. The last true teller died 40 years ago. Unfortunately for Bob Gobie, whatever the current teller's limitations, they could still work a simple curse. The next night, when Gobie got up to speak to the town council about plans to change the zoning laws, he opened his mouth and a frog came out to hop onto Joan Lafer's left breast and from there to the floor. Everyone laughed, but when Gobie again tried to speak and again a frog leapt out, people realized it was no prank. They began to back off and to push for the door. When Gobie shouted at them to stop, a winged lizard flew out of his mouth to fly right into the shrieking face of the town secretary. 5 days later, Gobie returned to the College of Tellers on Madison Avenue. He had walked all the way from his ranch house on Poughkeepsie's south side. He wore nothing but a black shirt with the sleeves ripped off and a dirty towel from the Young Men's Truth Association wrapped around his genitals and arse. When he came to the door, he crawled through the entranceway beneath the pictures of the founders until he came to the desk of the secretary he'd seen the week before. The man smiled. "What can I do for you?" he asked. Gobie looked at him. "Come on," the secretary said. "Don't be afraid. Tell me what you want." Gobie wondered if the man had lifted the curse. He opened his mouth and out came a dragonfly. "Very amusing," the secretary said. "Now will you tell me your problem?" Crying, Gobie signaled for paper and pencil. "No, no," the secretary said. "No forms. We're not that bureaucratic, whatever people say about us. Just tell me. Go ahead." Gobi's thumb jerked at his closed mouth. The secretary made a show of going back to his work. "I have no time for charades," he said. "If you won't say what's on your mind, I'm very busy." Gobie crawled away, having forgotten to get back on his feet. He took a train, no ticket required for a pilgrim, to the edge of the Oceanfront Spirit Reserve, and according to the forest rangers, was seen heading for the row of skulls on wooden poles that lined the forbidden beach. Many years later, during her own pilgrimage to the beach to talk to the skulls, Valerie Mazdan met a bent old man who sat hugging himself amid a congress of frogs. She walked over to him and parted the carpet of hair that covered his face. He blinked in amazement, not so much at the sight of another human as at the sun, hidden by his hair for so long he vaguely thought of it as a story he'd heard as a child. "Who are you?" Valerie said, kneeling down. The man shook his head. "You can tell me," coaxed courageous wisdom. "I won't hurt you." A flash of anger made the man open his mouth. A butterfly flew out, circled once around his head, then vanished in the sunlight. Valerie nodded, somewhat like a doctor acknowledging symptoms. She touched his lips. "Now," she said, "who are you?" The man thought to turn away from his tormentor, but something held him. He opened his mouth wide, as if to expel a great bullfrog at her. But instead a croak came out, not unlike the sound a frog makes as it digests its dinner of flies. "Go." Valerie touched his shoulder. "You just need practice," she said. "It's been a long time."
Thank you for that, Neil. Yeah. Also, just that, you know, our listeners, you can't see it, but everyone on the screen was smiling throughout the whole time. Just that, you know, case in point of her humor and the fun, you know. And why that passage specifically? Yeah,
because it draws such a beautiful picture for me of what she attempted and what she managed to do in Unquenchable Fire and in a lot of her fiction, which is create a world which is absolutely this world and is also a world of magic, a shamanistic world in which the rags have been ripped and the hair has been pulled from our eyes and we are staring directly at the sun. And somehow the fact that she can do both of those things and do them with humor, do them in essentially a genre that she invented and that nobody else has ever quite come back to. It's not magical realism. It's sort of shamanic, transcendent, urban Rachel.
Yeah, I'd like to add on to that if I could.
Absolutely, please do.
Yeah, several months after she died, I was back at the Omega Institute, and Zoe, her partner, took me to her grave site. And everything was lush and green because there had been lots of rain. It was just the lawn was perfectly green, except where her grave was, because there were still bare spots where the ground showed through. So I was taking some pictures, and I looked at the last one and realized that the bare spots, the brown spots, created the exact picture of her, the last of the major arcana in her Shining Tribe tarot, which is called Shining Woman, the World card. So the brown outlines against the green showed this dancing figure. And just as I was kind of in awe about this, a breeze came up really high up in the air, and there were lots of very, very tall trees around. And suddenly the air above was filled with these tiny little dancing golden leaves. And it was just swirling. And I watch a lot of Asian drama, and it was kind of like when a god dies in an Asian drama, they disperse into these little golden lights that fill the sky. That's pretty common in the stories in the TV dramas. So I'm standing there staring at this, these dancing golden leaves. I collected a couple of them. They were tiny. And I was in awe. I turned around to Zoe. She was looking the other way, so she didn't see it. We stayed about another hour walking around because it was a beautiful place just to take a walk. Occasionally the breeze would come up. I never once saw that again, and I never saw where those little golden leaves came from. I can't explain it. I'll share the pictures with you so that you can see, or the picture of Shining Woman. And that's what happens all the time. And if I could share one more thing, just a tiny bit of reading from, I pulled three cards today for our session here. The High Priestess for me, Three of Rivers, which is the same as the Three of Cups. In the traditional tarot, it's three women dancing together. In her deck, it's three rivers coming together. And it's all about community, and especially the feminine energy, because it's all the sources of the rivers are in the shape of vaginas. Typical. I noticed right away in her new book, she dedicated it to me. And so I'm said that was the what do I have to share with other people? And then the final one was just a message from her. And it's the awakening card in the tarot, which is the next to last card. And so I'd just like to read the short thing that she said. It's set in an urban setting instead of in this ocean that it's traditionally shown in. And the urban setting and the presence of a family imply community and responsibility to others. When we awaken, we understand our connections to the earth, to people around us, to our society, and to the web of life breathing and sleeping and waking all across our world. So we talk about woke consciousness. She reminds us that it's at a deep level for us individually, not just within the whole, field of woke, but that it's actually awakening. It's a constant, ongoing process of being part of all this. And it's the three women, which in the Three of Cups, which normally shows three women, here the three vaginas all merging. She dedicated it to me because I used to do menstrual rituals all around the
No.
West Coast with women's groups. So, yeah, but it's really about community, about what we share, and here especially, awakening.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mary. That is, yeah, that does seem very apt for, for one, this conversation, but also the life that Rachel lived.
It's magical. She still speaks in that magic directly to things that are happening and going on right now that we need to hear.
Absolutely, yeah. But that does make me think, well, another one of the questions that I sent ahead of time is, like, if Rachel were alive, how would she be interacting with our current world? But I love that story, Mary, because she is still interacting.
I mean, the magic of being someone like Rachel, both as a tarot expert, a tarot creator, and also as being an author, and an author who was in so many ways ahead of their time, is that I definitely have no feeling that, Rachel's work is done. Rachel may not be physically with us anymore, but Rachel's work absolutely continues. And more people are discovering her as an author. Just the fact that the Doom Patrol stuff was essentially 30 years ahead of its time, and the world caught up with it, and now it's being read. I think that there will come a time, maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10 years, maybe in 30 years, when somebody discovers Unquenchable Fire and Godmother Night and the Fisher King and Temporary Agency, these amazing books, and they become rediscovered, become part of the canon in the same way that books like, Moby Dick were forgotten, lost books for a long time, and suddenly became part of the canon. Rachel, as a writer, was way out in front of us. So we're catching up with her, I feel, rather than feeling like, well, what would happen if she were here today? She's here today, and she's way out in front of us.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, we're catching up to her. Yeah, and I've been reading the Doom Patrol omnibus of Rachel Pollack's run. I actually just got to the introduction of Codpiece, which is speaking to her humor and sort of a irreverency is a hilarious character. But I understand the significance of especially the character Coagula of Kate in the as being the first mainstream transgender superhero from what I understand it and yeah, so I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about that because Joe, you picked up that character for this create a new story for that so just a bit of a historical context perhaps and also just what it meant to you personally to see that character because also in the omnibus a little bit to what you were just speaking about, Neil, is she writes in the introduction about how she was at a transgender literary festival. She was surprised to understand it, and now I'm going to quote, "Those stories and Kate were an inspiration to a whole new generation of transgender cartoonists. A long time had passed, and I'd had no idea that the work was even remembered. This is the real superpower of Doom Patrol, to help people believe in themselves." And so I just like that as she did the work and enjoyed it, but wasn't even sure if it was re remembered, let alone had helped so many people see themselves. So Joe, I wonder if you could speak a little more about that.
Sure. I'll start quickly by just reading one of my favorite quotes from Kate Godwin, Coagula. What was it? She says, "Look at me. I change my body to match my vision, my desire. You can change easier than I can blink. But so what? I did it. I made it happen." Like that sort of, attitude of the character. And with Kate, again, as far as I know from everything, she was very much like the first mainstream comics out trans character, just in terms of a character who is supposed to be closer to the lived-in sort of trans experience. Kate certainly, that character. And Rachel just sort of got to do it. I think some of this is brought up in that introduction as well, of just like, well, we had this sort of like fill-in issue, and she sort of got to, put this character in who was, an amalgamation of, some of her friends and people with different, experiences. I think part of what makes her so interesting is that, she is this self-confident person while she is still trying to figure some things out and where she fits. Like, she is confident who she is, but not necessarily on where she's going just yet. As in her introduction, she's, maybe, she feels like she has to join the Justice League because that's what you're supposed to do if you have powers, but you have more options. And that's very much a coming of age sort of tale of, I'm this, so I have to do that. And, oh, I don't. I can, live my life and do these other things. And I mean, just that whole era, like Georgia Marion, going back to her humor, the SRS, sexually remanded spirits is doing that sexual reassignment, surgery, at data term now, but yeah, like all that sort of stuff. It's just, it's so interesting. And again, this plays to how sort of, creative and ahead of her time Rachel was, that no one really was able to take the ball and run with that character afterwards. And she sort of is killed off panel later. And and those things are complicated, right? Who can say, is it the creator, editor, whatever it is, that's neither here nor there. It's over 20 years ago, but now, she's back. I'm hoping, it sounds like there are people interested in her as a character, in using her in, hopefully future storylines and things like that. I think she's incredibly powerful. I mean, she has one of those powers that I think people maybe don't necessarily realize, like, oh, she can turn like liquids into solids and solids into liquids. And it's like, wow, that sounds like, does it get that much more powerful than that? I don't know, depending on the scale of it all. So I feel like there's really a lot of, powerful things you can do with her. And Rachel had some ideas, that didn't, get to come to fruition, but towards the end, on like things to do with her and or having her and Dorothy sort of together again on adventures and things like that. Hopefully one day we'll get to see someone run with that. But she was just such a strong, self-assured character. But you can be strong and self-assured, but also know that you don't know everything or don't know nearly as much as you wish to. And I feel like that's also Rachel. She was, very strong and self-assured, but she was incredibly humble and didn't try to come off as knowing everything there is, and was always curious, which is always funny because someone like Rachel probably, I don't know, I feel like she knows more about the world than almost anybody, but would probably be the first person to tell you that she, there's so much that she doesn't know. So it's weird how that works.
That's a great point. Yeah, the still being open to wanting to learn more, even though we all know she knew so much.
Oh, yeah.
I want to not really shift gears, but Neil, I came across a quote of yours in the Guardian's obituary, and you also mentioned the Jewishness and the those traditions. But I so I'm curious about that, about her religious beliefs and spirituality, and how that impacted her writing. But I loved that story that you share in that obituary, Neil, about the Orthodox prayer and how she twisted it after her. I don't wonder if you could, just to share
Oh,
some.
I've forgotten the name of the actual doctor, which makes me feel terrible. Is it, what was the name of what was the doctor's name? Is it in the thing?
No, it's, yeah.
We will invent one. But she was talking about the fact that one of the prayers that an Orthodox Jewish male is meant to say during the course of the day is, blessed to you, O Lord our God, who didn't make me a woman. And Rachel, upon coming back from surfacing from her surgery, said, and blessed to you, Dr. Stevens, who did. And there was a lovely, I think there was an irreverence to Rachel's pantheistic Judaism She was, I cannot think of many people, if anybody that I've ever known, who was more Jewish than Rachel. And yet that for Rachel was about who she was and what she knew and what she loved and the way she grappled with ideas of God and the way she was prepared to wrestle with God and wrestle herself a female God. Carve one for herself and examine that. She was a profound thinker. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to assume that when we talk about how funny she was, that we're saying, I forget who it was originally, probably somebody like G.K. Chesterton, who said that people make the mistake of thinking that funny is the opposite of serious. And in Rachel's case, she could be profoundly serious and profoundly funny at the same time and make you re-examine your own perceptions, your own preconceptions, and change your ideas. I remember, my first, hanging around with her at that first Milford, and it was 1985, and Rachel was the first trans person I had ever met. And I got to ask her every possible question. And a lot of them were questions which now people would just laugh at. You were that innocent, you were that foolish. But at that time, I know nothing. So I'm saying things like, so there are trans women. Could there be trans men too? And Rachel saying, oh, yes. And explaining to 20, 23, 24-year-old Neil Gaiman how the world works. My eyes were wide. And it was always with Rachel. She would just tell you things and you'd never be able to see them the same way again. Crazy Cat, famous comic book, not comic book, famous comic strip in the Hearst strips. It was Rachel who first told me that A, George Harriman, the creator of Crazy Cat, was passing as white, which I had not known, and B, that you can absolutely read Crazy Cat as a trans love story. Crazy Cat is crazy male, is crazy female. Crazy's pronouns tend to wander. Who loves who in this story and how? And how does that relate to somebody already passing and becoming, representing themselves for reasons of safety, survival, and economic security as something that they aren't? And I'd known none of this and had never thought of any of it. And suddenly you're talking to Rachel and your world has changed.
Yeah, I love that story. I also am curious, do you think it sounds like to me she was doing that also sort of personal interrogation, if you will, or, thinking about her own ideas and upbringing within her writing as well. And in the same sense of, how you, like you said, Neil, seeing her perspective on something changes you. And I'm curious if you can see her exploring her own beliefs and belief systems in her writing, and perhaps maybe with the spirituality of the tarot as well, Mary. How did her sort of personal navigation of those things, of her own beliefs, come out in her writing, both either in fantasy or tarot?
I can speak to tarot in that, where she wrote very basic books on tarot and then more advanced ones that get into all the symbolism and mythic relationships and as well as how it applies to a particular person. But then she wrote a book, A Walk Through the Forest of Souls. And that is using tarot to ask big questions. To ask questions about time and space and the creation of the world. What was God thinking when he or she created the world? you know, those were the kinds of questions that she asked in A Walk Through the Forest of Souls, asking us to, you know, not just stay within our, you know, what do I do next in my life kind of situation. You know, how do I get what I want in this world, which we tend to get fixated on when we look, you know, I'm going to a fortune teller, a reader. And neither Rachel nor I objected to being called fortune tellers. You know, destiny narration. That's perfectly a wonderful thing to be privileged to do. But that we can go beyond that to look much more deeply and come up with interesting questions, which she always did in herself, and never felt that she was stuck or fixed into a particular way of thinking. You know, she grew up with an Orthodox family because when she was very young, she had an illness, and for a while the doctors thought she might die, tried to prepare her parents for that. And so they prayed and promised, they hadn't been Orthodox, but they promised that if she was saved, they would become Orthodox. And so she lived, which was a surprise to everyone. And, you know, very much felt like a miracle to her parents. They felt that it was a direct answer to their prayer. And so she grew up in that Orthodox world. But again, this sense of humor about it. Like if you're not supposed to handle any kind or do any kind of work on the Sabbath on Friday, what if you have to go out to a synagogue on a Friday in New York City and you're not allowed to use the key because that's using an implement and it's work, which in ultra-conservative, that's actually a concern. And she said, oh yes, they all figured out that they could make a tie clip out of keys. And so she would tell me all these stories of how people would get around, you know, the strictures of, you know, being Orthodox in order to be able to live in our society and culture. And she found this endlessly fascinating. So, you know, what kinds of questions can we ask that look into not just this world that we live on, but the whole universe, the whole cosmos, the nature of being, relationship with our creatures that do inhabit our planet, and the trees and the, you know, birds and everything. We can relate to all these things. And that's what her deck shows. She went back to ancient, I hate to say ancient peoples, but or tribal peoples that even, you know, cave art and very ancient art from all the different cultures that she could come across to use those images that give life to different forms of being on this planet and in this cosmos.
Yeah, I love that. And that was that you're describing her own deck that she designed,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yeah. The Shining Woman Tarot. Or Shining okay. Tribe. She did a first edition, which was Shining Woman, very feminist, and then she redid it as Shining Tribe because she acknowledged that she had actually closed off to some extent the and needlessly so the fact that we were all a tribe on this planet, not just the humans either, but also, you know, the winged ones, the ones who walk on four legs, the trees, the plants. So they're all in there in the deck.
Great, thank you. As we're getting close towards the end here, were there any other stories that either of you wanted to share, or any other thoughts about Rachel that we haven't covered yet?
I would love to just throw in a tiny story about Rachel, which was just fun for me and changed the way that I saw my friend. Because as far as I was concerned, Rachel was my friend Rachel. And I knew she'd written some tarot stuff. And I knew but I thought of her primarily as a fantasy author and an incredibly good one. And I was writing a comic called The Books of Magic. And in it, I was going to need a tarot spread and cards and an explanation. And I went to Rachel and I said, look, I've got this character who's going to have to do the spread. This is the kind of thing that I need. could we actually do this for real, though? Can we actually, let's not go through and find the thing. Let's actually do it as for real. And she said, sure. She said, let's go first of all and just go and buy you a tarot deck. Let's find you a tarot deck that you're happy with to begin with for imagery. So we went down to a little shop. I think it's at the top of Neal Street in Soho. And it was called Mysteries or something like that. And it was a shop filled with crystal balls and tarot cards and so on and so forth. And I walked in and it was suddenly like being somewhere with the Beatles. As the people in the shop, both the people working in the shop and the customers realized that Rachel Pollack was among them, the shop got very hushed. The people were incredibly excited. She was suddenly signing things. It was like, and I went, oh my gosh, you are, I had not known my friend was a superstar. And there was nothing in the way that she carried herself, nothing in the way that she spoke, nothing in the way, you know, she was just Rachel and she was lovely and she was funny and she was smart. And suddenly going, oh, and you're a star as well, is one of those warm moments that I will take to my grave.
That's a great story. Yeah.
You know, she was a big fan of Philip K. Dick, for people who want to try to understand, you know, or the best that we could ever hope to understand Rachel and enjoying some of what she would read. I didn't realize, like, she was such a big fan of Philip K. Dick, and in particular, both of our favorite novels from his are Scanner Darkly. I brought that up in conversation, and then she was like, oh, you know, that's, you know, I you know, we were going on and on about Scanner Darkly. And again, very sort of Rachel of her. She was like, oh, you know, it's such a sad story. She's like, I could never read it again. So I listened to the audiobook of it. It was very like, oh, well, I guess that works. But and she had taught classes on Philip K. Dick. She would affectionately refer to Philip K. Dick fans as dickheads. So, you know, just all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it's interesting, too, the talk about, you know, her spirituality. And I feel like the duality of it comes across in a lot of her fiction is Rachel was somehow both more grounded than a lot of people you would ever meet, but also one of the most spiritual and thoughtful, and she did a very good job at like balancing that in such a way that I feel like, you know, she could find a way to connect with just about anybody. I mean, the fact that I got to be as good of friends with her as I am when we are generations apart and, you know, have very different upbringings and some different interests and things like that, and that we could spend hours talking about all sorts of things, I think was really a testament to how she understood people. And I think that's just another part of her legacy. Is I would be hard pressed to think of someone who understood people better than Rachel.
Yeah. And Mary, how about you? Any other final thoughts or anything that you wanted to talk about Rachel that we haven't covered yet?
So many thoughts were going through my head, agreeing with things that Joe was saying and that Neal had said. And well, she was a great, great friend. And at her memorial service, after she died at the Omega Institute, the thing that came out was there were so many people from all the different parts of her life that came. She was a teacher, and there were people that corresponded with her because she collected pens, fountain pens. And so she had all these correspondents with tremendous number. And I realized we never wrote to each other. We always called. I'm going, no, I don't have one of her letters and, you know, handwritten letters. But there were dozens of people who did. And you know, the depth of her friendships was amazing in so many different areas. Yeah, that's all I can say is, and in readings you could see she was totally present with the person when, you know, reading, doing sample readings in classes and so on, completely and totally present and with them wherever they were.
You just reminded me, I just have to one more quick little story. One of the last conversations I had with her on the phone, when she was still able to communicate while she was in a hospice, I was going to London, and I hadn't been to London before at that time. And you know, I was talking about the travel, and as soon as I said that, her piece of advice to me, which again goes to just how sweet and innocent Rachel is, I know this sounds like you hear this stuff, but really, make sure you're looking at the right side of the street before you cross, because the cars are like just the fact that just with everything she's going and talking about going there, and that her initial instinct was just to was for my safety, and just to be like, as an American, you have to make sure you're looking the right way when you cross the street, so you're not like he says, which is obviously just stuck with me. So
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you for that. Mary, thank you for your insights. And Neil, thanks for your insights as well. I had a blast talking with you all, and can't wait to share this.
well, thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much
you
for
for
having
inviting
us.
us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Wednesdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed only on Tuesdays for the summer. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.